The Lara Murphy Show, episode 68.
Welcome to The Lara Murphy Show, the podcast that analyzes financial markets from the perspective of Austrian economics and Nelson Nash's infinite banking concept. Listen and learn as your hosts, Robert Murphy and Carlos Lara, explain how you can be part of building the 10%.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of the Lara Murphy Show. With me, as usual, is Carlos Lara. Carlos, how are things up there in Nashville?
Well, you know, Bob, everybody I've run into today has had a smile on their face. And I know what's going on. First of all, the rain has stopped here in Nashville, and we've got a pleasant 60 degrees, and the sun is out, and everybody's in a happy mood, and it's kind of rubbed off on me. So I'm feeling good.
Yeah, you do seem surprisingly chipper. And I should mention, by the way, last time we talked, I think you were talking about getting flooded, and I sort of poo-pooed that. I didn't realize, like, you weren't kidding. Like, you guys actually got hit with a boatload of rain.
Yeah, we did. We really did. Everybody in Nashville is happy that the rain is finally gone.
All right. Well, that's good. I'm glad. We're happy that you're happy. So, folks, what we're doing right now in this episode, so again, this is episode 68. This is going to be part one of a three-part series, so 68, 69, and 70. And it's going to be on IBC and the business owner. So that's this three-part series that we're starting. Now, I had toyed originally with saying, make sure you listen to this episode because at the end, we're going to have a special announcement, but that's goofy. Why don't we just tell you up front what the big picture is here? We are going to have a seminar for business owners who are interested in IBC and, of course, who also like the Austrian School of Economics. And it's going to be held in Nashville, Tennessee, on Friday, May 10th. Of course, this is 2019 that we're recording this. And in order for you, if you know right now you want to go, because there's only 25 slots, so the first 25 business owners who sign up are the 25 that get in for this one, you want to go to laramurphy.com/bizowner. So that's LARA-murphy.com/BIZ owner. Biz owner. Okay. So laramurphy.com/biz owner will take you to the registration page where you can see all the information. It's a full day conference on that Friday, May 10th. We're going to be talking about both Austrian economics and specifically the business cycle, and then trying to relay that, you know, the general generic Austrian theory of the boom bust cycle to the particulars of the U.S. economy and what the Federal Reserve's doing and will have done up through May 10th by that point. And also Carlos in particular is going to be, you know, giving presentations on how the business owner in particular uses IBC to his or her advantage. And again, it's going to be an all-day affair, plenty of instruction, lots of breaks, lots of built-in Q&A periods. So that's why we're limiting it to 25 people, because we want the business owners who come to this event to really be able to get direct time with us and, you know, ask us specific questions about what they're doing in their businesses. And we can give direct feedback during the broad Q&A. If somebody wants me to take 10 minutes to explain, you know, to elaborate on some point that I made in my presentation, you know, we have the time to do that. This isn't going to just be a thing where there's a huge crowd. You have a question and boy, geez, I wish I had more time with you, Murph, and you could explain it. Well, now this is your opportunity. You will have more time with us. So that's what it's going to be. Carlos, do you want to, at this point, say anything further about this seminar we got coming up?
Well, I'm very excited about doing this, Bob. I'm glad we came up with the idea to do this. I like the idea that we're limiting it just to 25 people. I really do, because as you know, when we first started talking to audiences and trying to integrate Austrian economics with IBC, I mean, we were speaking to audiences of 500, 700 people at a time. And we were always so conscious of the time, you know, there was never really any time for Q&A. And so the idea of doing it for business owners and limiting it to just the 25 individuals, the first 25 that sign up, and having enough Q&A time for them to ask questions, and we spend time with each one. I think it's going to be great. I'm really looking forward to it.
Yeah, I am as well. And so to tie it back to what we're doing here on the podcast series, it's not going to be like infomercials. You know, it's not like you're watching some commercial on TV and it's telling you about, like, get these new kitchen knives and the whole thing is a big commercial. That's not what we're doing. But what we are going to do is, over this and the next subsequent two episodes of this three-part series, we're going to be talking about IBC and the business owner and the state of the U.S. economy and what the Fed's doing, things of particular interest to business owners. So this, think of it as, if you like the stuff we cover in this and the next two episodes, well, there's going to be a lot more of that going on at this all-day seminar. So that's kind of the connection and why we're mentioning them at the same time here. So again, we will be continually, of course, reminding people about the seminar and encouraging you to sign up. But what we're doing here is not just a big infomercial. This, we are going to just be talking about these topics in an abbreviated form here on the podcast. So to that end, I think probably the most obvious thing to talk about right now, the breaking news, and this is just a coincidence that it happened this way. We already were, you know, planning on talking about IBC and the state of the economy and so forth, is the recent Fed announcement that, as we're recording this, it just happened yesterday, but by the time you guys hear this episode, it will be, you know, a little bit further in the past, where the Fed came out and they announced, you know, so it was construed as a relatively dovish announcement in the sense that they once again didn't do rate hikes, but the big deal was talking about giving more details about their bond roll-off program. And what's interesting, Carlos, is I know you contacted me and said, hey, did you make sure you realize this is what the Fed said? And I went and looked at the official Fed announcement. You know, so in other words, the official press release that the Federal Reserve site gives after they make one of these announcements. And in the actual formal announcement, it doesn't mention anything about the bond roll-off program. So I thought that was interesting. I don't know if you realize that, Carlos, but if you get what I'm saying, that all they talked about in their official normal press release was what they were doing with interest rates, and we're going to continue to monitor the data closely and blah, 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 blah. So if all one did was quickly skim the official press release, one would not have realized they said anything about the bond roll-off. It's only, you know, what they did elsewhere. So I don't know. I don't know if you caught that. And I know you had some thoughts too about the different ways you were getting this information filtered to you.
Well, of course, you know, they made the announcement, and a lot of the news media was starting to send out messages right away that they were going to not have any more interest rates hikes, you know, for the rest of this year, which is a very positive type of an announcement. The other one was that the Fed was going to slow down the roll-off and actually stop it at the end of September, was the announcements that I was getting from some of the mainline, you know, news organizations. And, of course, at that moment, those two seemed like very positive moves, the kind of thing that Wall Street would want to hear. And I expected the stock market to start shooting up right away, but it didn't do that. You know, there was a feeling, I think, still among investors out there, especially the big investors, that things were really not as clear as they seem. And so I did do a little bit further investigating. I looked up the report, the actual live report, that the press conference, and listened to it very carefully. And there were some indicators there that there is no plan to increase the interest rate, you know, this year. But it was always predicated with if everything, you know, is going along smoothly. It was always predicated by something like that. But they were going to take the position of watching things very, very carefully. And as far as the roll-off of the balance sheet, they were going to reduce the amount of treasuries coming off the balance sheet and then plan on stopping it by the end of September. And so they were going to continue to roll off the mortgage-backed securities, because I don't think they want to hold those at all. So they were going to let those continue. If you remember, Bob, they were rolling off $20 billion of those a month, of the mortgage-backed securities, and $30 billion of the U.S. Treasuries a month, so for a total of $50 billion. And so they're gonna slow up the Treasury roll-off considerably, down to about $15 billion. And so I started looking at how much that's going to be in terms of a roll-off by the end of September, and it looks like there's a differential of around $48 billion of what it would have normally been if they'd have just kept it going the way it was.
Do you have the absolute figures at your fingertips?
I don't have them actually in front of me, but I do remember doing the calculation as I was looking to see, you know, what was coming, what was going to be maturing over the next several months. I just kind of did a quick tally. And so the rough numbers I had was that if they'd had left the roll-off the way it was going, there would have been a reduction of something like $173 billion by the end of September. But now that they're going to, you know, shorten the amount, it'll be actually a total of about $125 billion. So it's a difference of $48 billion in what will actually come off by the end of September.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And so in one sense, what I get from that, I don't know what you think, Bob, but they haven't really stopped the roll-off. And it doesn't, even with the language that's there, doesn't say that they may not continue it. In fact, they're just kind of saying we're going to have to wait and see what we'll do after that. So that's the general sense that I got from what they were saying.
Right. So I won't dwell on this because I think in previous episodes, certainly in the Lara Murphy report, I've carefully explained these distinctions. But just so people don't get lost here, remember, normally to say, oh, the central bank is going to raise interest rates, that's the same thing as saying the central bank's going to sell off assets, right? Because the way the central bank raises rates above what they would otherwise be is the central bank sells off some of its assets, or if they're, if they're bonds that mature, it refrains from rolling them over so that their assets shrink, on their balance sheet as the people pay the principal and the bond disappears. If the Fed doesn't reinvest those proceeds, that money just disappears from the economy, right? Because the Fed can create and destroy money effectively by buying and selling assets. So that's what's special about the Fed in that regard. So normally to say, oh, the Fed wants to raise interest rates is the same thing as saying the Fed is going to let its assets shrink, because that effectively sucks dollars out of the system. Other things equal, if there's fewer dollars in the financial sector, then the cost of borrowing dollars overnight goes up. So that's how the Fed raises interest rates. And vice versa, if they want to push down interest rates, they go out and buy assets and hence in the process create new money that floods the financial sector. Okay, so that connection between those two activities was divorced during this crisis, that specifically in October of 2008, right, the month right after the fall of Lehman and the takeover of AIG and the world was ending, oh my gosh, getting the TARP money and all that stuff. It was right then that the Fed began paying interest on reserves, and that's how it started separating the interest rate target from the Fed's balance sheet. And so now, because the Fed could just directly change the interest rate it paid to commercial banks to keep money parked at the Fed, that's how the Fed could, for example, when the Fed wanted to start raising interest rates, which it did to December of 2015, is when the Fed started raising interest rates, it didn't need to start selling off bonds to do that. All it did was raise the interest rate that it paid commercial banks, but it kept its balance sheet the same. And it was only in October of 2017, right, so well after it started raising rates, that the Fed started letting its balance sheet shrink. Okay, so those two things have been divorced, but normally those two things go hand in hand, and here they've been divorced. And so even there, the fact that it was in October 2017 where they started doing this bond roll-off, it was really tepid at the beginning, right? So in other words, they had bonds maturing, and up till then, they had just been rolling them over, right? So the Fed's assets were constant. I think it was around October of 2014 is when the Fed started treading water in terms of the size of its balance sheet. That's when the original QE3 tapered off and wound down. And so the Fed stopped adding to its balance sheet at that point and then just was treading water. So as bonds matured, they would just roll the proceeds over and go buy more bonds to replace the maturing ones so that the total holdings were the same. So they stopped doing that in October of 2017. So now as bonds were maturing and they had principal payments coming in, they would only roll over some of that. And so they started allowing a growing gap between how much they were getting repaid in principal and then how much they were reinvesting. So they were reinvesting less each month and they were getting paid back in principal. So on net, the total amount of outstanding face value of the bonds they were holding was shrinking. And they were making that accelerate. All right. So that didn't really kick in earnest until 2018. And in particular, the second half of 2018. And that's when we saw, if you folks remember, all the extreme volatility in the financial markets with the stock market, you know, going up and down like crazy, but also trending downward in the last quarter in particular of 2018. That was when this bond roll-off program was really in full gear. Incidentally, Carlos, even though officially they were going to, you know, max out at a maximum monthly rate of $50 billion in reducing their total bond holdings, a mix of treasuries and mortgage-backed securities, at least the numbers I'm looking at in terms of the size of the Fed's balance sheet, it never really got that high. It was like some months it was like maybe they sold off $48 billion, but other months it was like $42. So I'm saying it's not like there was a string of a bunch of months in a row where the Fed was literally reducing its balance sheet by $50
billion. That's true.
I think that was just an upper ceiling. So what I noticed was happening is, you know, markets were panicking and then Powell and those guys were coming out and saying, okay, well, maybe now we're going to end the bond. This would have been like a month or two ago. Say, we're going to end the bond roll-off program sooner now than we originally planned. But since in the beginning, they never told us when they were going to end it, you didn't really know what that meant. So you may remember, Carlos, my joke at the think tank was to say, basically Powell's telling people, I'm thinking of a number up and now I'm thinking of a smaller number, you know, and then markets are supposed to respond to that. And so that's what they were doing. So I think what's special about this is they're actually now giving us a specific timeline, even though, again, they're giving themselves an out. They don't have to stick to this if conditions change. But here they are given some more specificity. And so I think what they're trying to do is they want to goose the stock market by committing to as little as possible. So originally they were just trying to say, well, we're not going to raise rates, but they were still letting the bond roll-off occur and that didn't work. And so then they said, oh, okay, well, we're going to end the bond roll-off sooner than we originally thought without really giving any specifics, and that didn't work. And so now I think they're going to try, okay, well, let's tell them we're going to end it in September and see what happens, you know? So, so I think, you know, even, and you're right, Carlos, I had the same experience where I saw the headlines on CNBC, oh, markets respond favorably, and the markets were still down. So I wasn't watching it, you know, tracking it every 10 minutes. So maybe the markets had been way down and then boosted back up, but the market was still down for the day as of when I saw these headlines about how the market responded favorably to the dovish Fed announcement. So I thought that was kind of funny. So, you know, I don't want to dwell on this too much longer, but yeah, I think that's where we are. And obviously, folks, you know, if you come to the seminar, and I'll be talking about this too in the Laura Murphy report to some extent, but yeah, we can get into much more specifics. But I think you're right, Carlos, that as of right now, even with their amended time frame, they're still selling off. So it's two things. Number one is the rate at which they're selling it off. If you blamed the stock market volatility in late 2018 on the bond roll-off, we're still in store for a similar thing over the next few months. In terms, you know what I'm saying? It's not that big of a difference in terms of how much are they planning on selling off for the next 3 months, let's say, versus how much did they sell off in the fourth quarter of 2018. So there's that element. And then beyond that is, suppose they do stick to this plan, well, then they're going to end up with having a balance sheet that's still way higher than it was going into the crisis. And so in terms of, you know, will they be back to normal? I think absolutely not. So again, I want to get out the numbers and do some calculations before I see anything more tangible on that. But my point is, so as of right now, for example, just to give people an idea of what I'm talking about, the maximum of the Fed's balance sheet was $4.2 trillion. And up till now, they've let roll off about $450 billion of that. Okay, so, you know, clearly they're still going to have more than, what, $3 trillion if they just let things go, you know, if they let things play out according to what they're saying here. And, you know, they had under $800 billion in assets, you know, going into the financial crisis. So you can see the issue here that if they're telling the world, yeah, we went back to normal, you know, we had this huge crisis in 2008, we did the three rounds of QE, blew up the Fed's balance sheet, but don't worry, this isn't inflationary, we're going to suck that money out when the economy recovers, and now unemployment's 4%, and they're telling us we're going to stand pat now with a balance sheet that's still $3 trillion or more. I mean, that's, you know, that doesn't make any sense. That's still a very bloated Fed balance sheet. And so you really haven't gotten out of the problem. So I guess those are my thoughts in terms of the recent Fed announcement.
Yeah. And I did hear him say that he was predicting that the balance sheet would be at $3.5 trillion by the end of September. And I agree with you. It's still way too high. As you said, before all this started, it was somewhere around $980 billion. So I still see the liquidity continue to have to come out of the economy.
By the way, and, good job, Carlos. While you were talking, I went to look it up to make sure, and you're right. In early September, it was like $925 billion. So your back of the envelope calculation or recollection was better than mine. Good job.
Yeah, thanks. But anyway, the thing that is working against all of this is that things are slowing down. You know, the economy is slow. There's all kinds of signs everywhere the economy is slowing down. And, of course, I think I agree with what you're saying. They did what they did to see if they could goose the stock market up, keep it up, because that's the main indicator that the people look toward to get a feeling that things are well, if it's the stock market is up. So I can see that this was very cleverly done not to bring the stock market down. But as we all know, just by reading, you know, the headlines that are coming out on a daily basis, you know, things are slowing down considerably on across all sectors now, and not just here in the United States, but abroad. And China is slowing down a lot. So all these are signs that we're heading toward a recessionary period. And so another reason why I believe that this is critically important, especially for business owners, a recession is not a good thing. And you know, if you've ever been and heard any of my presentations, I always talk about that one of the most important things that business owners pay attention to is their sales, their revenue. They've got to have those sales and revenue continuously coming in because they've got to pay expenses every day. And so a recession means that revenue is going to slow down or drop drastically. Now, if that happens, of course, it'll create all kinds of problems for businesses. Obviously, they'll start letting go of people, you know, so you'll see an unemployment because payroll is obviously the number one expense for businesses. They'll start closing locations if necessary because rent is the second largest expenditure of businesses. So a recession, you know, is in the horizon is something that business owners need to prepare for because it will have some very adverse effects on their businesses. Now, what we do know also, Bob, is that most small businesses, when we speak of small businesses, are said to be always undercapitalized. And what is meant by that is they generally don't have enough working capital to be able to sustain any kind of a downtrend in the economy. That's why they're so dependent on credit and financing, either trade credit or bank credit or something to deal with some of these ups and downs of cash flow. But when you have a recession, you know, hit a business, it can spell big problems. So not having enough working capital simply means that you don't have enough cash flow to sustain a downturn. And of course, IBC and what we'll be talking about in this particular seminar that we're going to be having in Nashville is, you know, why a business owner needs to consider very seriously using IBC as their primary cash flow system instead of what they're currently using right now, which is very susceptible to problems when a recession hits. The other thing that is always surprising, and that I find that a lot of people just don't realize, is that a small business, according to the definition that we get from some of the groups out there that put together figures and statistics on businesses, is that a small business is defined as a business that has less than 500 employees. Well, as you can, you know, that a company that has as much as 500 employees is a big company.
Right.
It's not a small business. Mm-hmm. Okay. That can be a very large business. At the same time, when you think about how many large businesses do we have in the United States? That's businesses that have over 500 employees. Well, there's only 18,600 businesses in the United States that have over 500 employees. So it's always important to recognize that wide disparity between what is a small business and a large business. Another thing that I find is very it always comes as news to a lot of even business owners don't even know this a lot of times, that we have 28 million businesses in the United States, but only 5.8 million of those are businesses that have at least one employee. 23 million businesses in the United States don't even have a single employee. They just have one individual that's operating some sort of a taxing entity. And so when they calculate the numbers, it shows up as a business, which is very, very interesting.
Can I stop you? Do you mean, like, for example, my consulting business right now, I'm the only employee, Robert Murphy. Like, so it writes checks to Robert Murphy as paychecks. Is that what you mean? Or you mean, no, there's like literally zero, like there's not even somebody that they pay for labor services.
Well, you would be, obviously, you would be an individual, a taxing entity. I can't remember, you told me, but you are a taxing entity of some sort. You're either an S corporation or—
Yeah, I'm an S corp.
Okay, an S corp. So we have these different taxing entities and, you know, that represents a business. And it could be just the individual that runs the business that incorporated the taxing entities, but they have no employees. They're the only person, you know, in the business.
Right. That's all I was asking you, though. So before, when you were saying five, whatever the number was, of the million of these businesses don't have any employees, do you mean they're like me? So it's like a self-employed plumber, but he has his own company? Or you mean it's really just an artificial entity that—
Well, what I'm saying is that mm-hmm. there's 23 million of the 28 million businesses that are out there that have no employees. I mean, somebody has incorporated them into a taxing entity, but they have no employees. So there's only 5.8 million businesses that have someone that incorporated the business and have then at least one employee and up to 500 employees, if that makes more sense.
I realize you keep making statements, but I'm not sure. So what's my company? Am I part of the 5 million that have at least one employee? Because, my company's employee is Robert Murphy? Or is that what you mean? No.
Yeah, I mean, that's what you would have is one employee in your company.
Okay, sorry to keep belaboring that, but I just wanted to make sure people understood. Are you talking about, no, these are strictly just tax vehicles versus a self-employed operation. Okay,
right,
gotcha.
Right. But again, I was trying to make clear to everybody that when you speak about, well, what's a large business? Well, a large business is any company has over 500 employees. And how many of those are there in the United States? There's only 18,600 large businesses in the United States, which is incredible when you realize there's 28 million businesses in the United States, that's all the large businesses that we have. But then again, about 1,000 of those companies, 18,000 companies that are out there, 1,000 of them have over 10,000 employees. So we get into some very large businesses within that grouping. Walmart, for example, is a company that has something like 2.3 million employees, which is huge.
Right.
Compared to Amazon, which has 566,000 employees, also a lot of employees. Mm-hmm. So you can get into, you know, some big numbers up there.
What's interesting too, so you're saying that's the classification, like you're getting that stuff from, you know, some presumably some federal government depository. What's funny about that is like the Affordable Care Act, you know, had the employer mandate was for businesses that had 50 or more employees. Mm-hmm. So it's funny that for that, you know, the threshold they had in mind in terms of, oh, we don't want to shackle a small business with these mandates for health insurance, but you know, the big companies that can afford it. And but in that context, if you had 50 or more employees, which and partly that was one of the predictions was that, okay, so now if you're a company that had 48 employees, you sure as heck aren't going to hire two more.
That's right. But an even a more impressive statistic is that it registers 118 million employees in the United States, and that 57 million of those, or 48% of all employees, are employed by privately held businesses. And that's a pretty impressive number. And why, you know, the closely held corporation is still a vital part of our economy. And so a lot of times the news seems to be so concentrated, you know, with what's going on and on Wall Street, you know, and that kind of thing. But it's really that you know, the private business sector that is a major foundation of our entire economy. That's an important statistic to never forget.
And for the benefit of casual listener or, you know, people who don't really hear when you're talking about like a privately, you know, closely held corporation versus Wall Street, you don't mean private sector versus government. You mean like when we talk about, oh, this company went public or this is now a publicly held corporation. In this context, that means shares that you can buy and sell on the open stock exchange, let's say, as opposed to, you know, some family business where the family owns the company.
Yeah,
where they, you know, you might have a private, your buddy that you and your buddy go in and your partners in the company. The quote, the public can't buy a share of stock in that corporation because it's a privately held one.
That's correct.
Okay.
And yeah, it's those kind of companies, you know, privately held companies that employ 48% of the U.S. population.
And so here a related thing too is, you know, and there's like Republican politicians, especially when they're running for office, you know, they'll talk about, and we're going to lower taxes because we want to provide incentives for the job creators. Even though a lot of those guys are bluffing, let's say, like they really don't know that much about economic theory or whatever, there is a lot to be said for that, you know, in terms of especially from an Austrian perspective, you know, this is what the entrepreneur does, that it's the entrepreneur who looks out at the world and, you know, has an idea, has a vision and realizes, oh, wait a minute, you know, I can buy resources, hire workers, you know, buy raw inputs, rent a factory, whatever, create a product or service and sell it. And I bet you I can get enough revenue from willing customers to cover those explicit costs plus, you know, the rate of return on my investment that, you know, is as good as I'm going to earn elsewhere. And somebody who sees that opportunity and sees it and is correct, well, that person has now, you know, played a fundamental role in allocating resources to where the consumers want them to be allocated. So that, you know, in the Austrian view, that's what it is that entrepreneurs do. And if you're wrong, then you suffer losses. But the point is, it's the entrepreneur who changes the world, who, you know, who sees what is the world lacking right now, or how can I make a difference? Whereas in their role, strictly speaking, as a wage earner, you know, the worker is just told what to do. So you might be a highly productive person, and that's great. But in terms of, you know, who is it that decides we should build a hospital here? Or who is it that decides, you know, there ought to be a factory here that makes cars. So if you're somebody who's very skilled, you know, working particular machinery or whatever, and so you work at the car factory and you get paid a great wage, that's good. And you're definitely contributing to the economy. But the point is, you're not the one who decided there should be a car factory here. Like, so those types of decisions are the ones that it's the entrepreneurs making who help steer the economy and answer some of the big picture questions you know, this goes back to Ludwig von Mises' critique of socialism, that, you know, that you, instead of having central planners do it, these decisions are decentralized, they're dispersed. And the way our private property market economy works is anybody who wants to can try to start a business. And if it works, great. And if not, you go out of business. And you know, that's the way the feedback, you get profit and loss. So of course that's all tied in here. And that's why, you know, if you are an entrepreneur or you're someone who's right now a salaried employee, but you're thinking about starting a business or whatever, I mean, that's what it is, right? You're just sitting around thinking, what is the world lacking right now? That's what you do as an entrepreneur. And, you know, in some cases, if it's just like, well, I'm going to open up my own dental practice on this road because I bet you I'd get enough traffic. I mean, that certainly counts, right? No one else has done it. And if you do it and you're right, that's good. But, you know, even, of course, more advanced esoteric things like Steve Jobs, you know, in his garage starting Apple with his buddy. I mean, that, of course, is a more, you know, a sexier example, but there's still the same fundamental thing. Last thing I'll say on this, if people are interested, on the Bob Murphy Show, episode 23, I interview Peter Klein, and he a lot of his work is on entrepreneurship. So if you want to see from a more academic-y point of view, you know, these discussions and what does Israel Kirzner say and what does Murray Rothbard say and that kind of stuff, I'll point you to that. So I'll link it in the show notes page, but that was bobmurphyshow.com/23. So that's why too, Carlos, I think when we talk about a business owner, we don't just mean, you know, it's a certain type of person. And in my experience, the business owners that we've dealt with, they seem to get IBC more quickly than somebody who's a wage earner.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I should probably say this too, Bob, that if you're listening to this this podcast and you may be thinking about coming to the seminar and you're trying to make a determination, is this for me? Just keep in mind that whether you have 10 employees, you have 500 employees or more, the subject we're going to be talking about is cash flow. So that's going to apply to whatever size business you are. So just remember that IBC is about cash flow and financing. So it's going to be applicable to a small or a large business, both.
Yeah. Also, let me just mention, too, as we're winding up this episode, it's true that we're here interspersing stuff about me talking about the business cycle and Carlos sort of giving, I don't know, a tutorial to business owners on how to use IBC for your business. And the reason is simply because those two things are really hot right now, in the sense of I have lots of people in terms of my consulting business that has one employee, as we've just established, you know, asking me, okay, yeah, Bob, here's my business model. And, you know, I really need your feedback here. You know, don't just tell me, oh, the Fed pushes interest rates down and causes a boom. Like, I really need to get some more actionable information here, Bob. Like, what am I looking for? You know, what's the timeline? That kind of stuff. And so, you know, I just know a lot of business owners want that. And again, Carlos is getting hits on the our website asking for, this is how my business works and, you know, exactly what do I do with IBC. So that's the reason for mixing these two things together in the same seminar. But it's what we're not saying is, oh, the reason you would use IBC is if you think there's a big crash coming. That even if the Fed, you know, even if we were on a gold standard or whatever and everything was great, IBC would still make sense. You still want to become your own banker, you know, in terms of Nelson Nash is the title of his famous book. You still want to take control of the banking function. It's just that it's a really good idea to not be dependent on outside lenders and to have, like, if you're a business, you don't want to just be dependent on some bank line of credit. And that's how you always get through, you know, the mid months in the summer when your revenues fall or something. You don't want to be in that position if a big crash comes. Then you're really in trouble. So that's the reason we're sort of packaging this together. It's not that IBC only makes sense in a world of the business cycle caused by the Fed or something like that. Well, I guess, Carlos, do you have any parting words of wisdom for the folks as they eagerly await part two of our series on IBC and the business owner?
Well, I'm just, again, I'm very excited that we've made the decision to do this particular seminar, and I'm looking forward to meeting whoever comes to it. I think it's going to be one of the best ideas we've come up with yet.
I am excited as well. So again, folks, you want to go to lauramurphy.com/bizowner, BIZOWNER, to get the details about this and you know, see the exact logistics. Also, I should mention, if you do come to it, presumably you're going to stay over, you know, through Friday night and leave Saturday from Nashville, or maybe you want to stay longer, but there will be karaoke Friday night. So that you can count on. That will be more assured than the Fed hitting its dual mandate. Well, thanks everybody for listening, and we will see you next time.
You've just finished another episode of The Laura Murphy Show. Be sure to share this podcast with your friends and colleagues to do your part in building the 10%.
The Laura Murphy Show is provided with the understanding that the staff and contributors of LauraMurphy.com are not herein engaged in rendering legal, accounting, tax, or investment advice. On such matters, please consult your own professional tax, legal, or financial advisor.